Okay, well, why don't we get started tonight? Tonight's session is on asking questions, and I had some handouts that I gave out yesterday, and I will pass out some lists of great questions. These are not original by any means, and you'll have to sort of buddy up and share. I did not make nearly enough copies.
Can you read them?
You can actually rip them apart and just look through them. These are all questions that are available on the StoryCorps website for interviewing each other. I meant to mention this last night. About five years ago, NPR tried to create its own holiday tradition, and I think it's working, called the National Day of Listening, which is the day after Thanksgiving instead of going shopping. We created this in the year of the Great Recession, so nobody had money to go shopping anyway. So it was that, and these were some of the questions we provided as part of the National Day of Listening and StoryCorps to basically interview your relatives, talk to your family members on the day after Thanksgiving, since you're all stuck somewhere in bad weather anyway. I have never tried this because nobody in my family will talk to me. So, I mean, they won't answer questions because they think I'm being nosy, which I am.
Probably think you're going to put it on air.
They think I'm being nosy, which I am. I always
think things they probably think they'll be on the radio. Yeah.
I don't bring recording.
Well, you can hide it.
That's unethical. As it says at the end of the Robert Siegel chapter, you have to let the people know you're recording, that you are recording. I do that by saying, I have started recording. Please say your name to acknowledge that I've started recording, that you know that I've started recording. So tonight, I'm going to just, rather than last night where we played some actual oral histories that you didn't get to hear the questions being asked, tonight I'm going to play some interviews where you actually do get to hear the questions being asked. They're not oral histories. The first one is an interview between Susan Stamberg and Richard Avedon. I think that's the only one where the person isn't introduced until the last one. So I will start this one, and I want to then talk about the subject that they talk about in for a few minutes, and we'll move on. Each of these interviews is somewhere between 2 and 4 minutes until the last one, which is a bit long.
You said something so interesting about your gift being not to take pictures of inanimate objects, but instead to take pictures of very animate ones indeed. Marian Anderson, that classic photograph, her hair streaming across the side of the photograph. Marilyn Monroe, the nude Nastasia Kinsky wrapped in a python. Everybody who's ever looked at a poster in a college dormitory knows that photograph of yours. And you once said that a portrait photo session involves unearned intimacy. I never forgot that, and I wish you'd explain what you mean about it.
I think it's very much like what you and I are doing now. We don't know each other. You have your agenda, I have mine. You have the right to ask me anything you want. We're the same person, Susan. We use people to express ourselves. I mean, there's no question you can't ask me in the next few minutes that I won't have to respond to. The result will be the result of the two of us dealing with this unearned intimacy. I mean, if you came over to me at a party and asked me the kinds of questions you could ask me or are asking me now, mm-hmm. I would either turn away or say, are you an anchor lady or what is this? You know, this is not a normal conversation, Susan. I don't talk about myself. You don't go around interviewing people, I hope, at dinner, you know? So what we're doing, you must understand me perfectly. I mean, you cannot interview the Empire State Building,
right?
But you can interview me, and we both must have this feeling about other people.
Uh-huh. But in a photography session, people can, just as they can in the interview, I can be lied to. Well, so can you.
That's right.
There at your camera.
And if someone lies to me in front of my camera, I think that's interesting. I don't want to get through anything. I think a person who's lying is really interesting. Much more interesting than some bore who tells the truth.
or the fact that he or she is lying then becomes who they are.
That's right.
In your photograph.
That's right. And that's interesting. And that doesn't mean it's the last word, and my truth isn't anybody else's truth. It's just, I guess, at bottom, in a way of expressing my feelings through them, writing my autobiography with other people's faces.
Weary. Mm-hmm. So I like and I don't like parts of this interview. Part of it is that Richard Avedon comes off as a real ass. Narcissistic. And I love his photography, but I apparently wouldn't have liked him. But I love this idea that he talks about, which is unearned intimacy, which is, I think, something that all journalists have to deal with. And everybody who is interviewed has to sort of either decide to or not decide to grant that sort of intimacy. In the Telling True Stories excerpt that I gave you, she talks about it as accelerated intimacy. And you're trying to get to this moment of, you know, sometimes in just 20 minutes, you're trying to get to this moment of this person is telling you something important to them, but you, as the interviewer, are trying to, you know, get them to warm up to you, to tell them things that they need to hear in order for you to tell them, to get them to tell you the truth. And I always found this as an interviewer one of the hardest parts of my job, which was trying to figure out what I needed to say to get the person to speak to me more truthfully. And I sort of came up with this concept that I've heard is sometimes used in social work, but I didn't know that at the time, called selective disclosure, where I would like decide to say something that was true about myself just to get them talking, like, oh, I had an experience like that, just to basically help them understand that, like, I had had some kind of common experience that we could talk about, or that would help me understand what you were trying to say. But I also I know that that's incredibly manipulative, because I wouldn't tell them everything. I wouldn't tell them anything that was untrue, but I would tell them enough of the truth that I thought they needed to hear in order to actually talk to me. And I hope that I didn't become a monster doing that, but I am interested in the notion, and I wonder what your thoughts are about that idea. I assume that people who are, say, therapists or pastors sometimes have to do that to get people to open up. You have to reveal something about yourself. Yeah?
I'm full of beans. I guess my question is, why does it have to be true? If you're trying to get to the real story, and asking a question or revealing something, why must what you say be true? Why can't you say, even if you haven't had that kind of an experience, yes, I know someone who, or I have, or, you know, in order to get the response.
I wouldn't make up something. I mean, part of all you really have as a journalist is your integrity and your honesty.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm bad at math, I can't spell, but what I can do is be honest with people.
Well, I think personally, interviews are a developing of a relationship, and you just can't develop a relationship, you know, on false premises.
I guess the reason I ask is because I have often, as a teacher, told stories that are not true. I have often said, yes, there was a blank that had the same situation that you do, and the way they did it was, or what they learned from it was, and it's a teaching tool that I have used. And that's why I kind of brought it up. You know, no, I didn't ever know an organization that had that, but I have a piece of information I want to relay, which is about, instead of saying, here's what you should do, or the best way to do that, or experts say la la la, I once knew somebody, or I know an organization that, or I had a group that, or I worked with somebody that, and then the story emerges and the teaching occurs.
I think that's a parable.
Yeah.
What you're saying. Okay. But I mean, it works for me in developing a relationship. So that's why I asked about it in an interview situation.
Right. I mean, I don't know any journalists who would make it up.
Make it up
the story.
That's interesting.
Would you, when you were interviewing somebody, you know, you're interviewing me, you're interviewing any one of the people here, you know, we don't have a large body of work that tells you what we are about. So how differently is that than if you were interviewing, say, a Madonna or, you know, somebody that is well known?
Madonna is a terrible interview. Every time she's been interviewed, she just can barely speak. In this Susan Stamberg, Richard Avedon, you know, he was a well-known photographer. She was able to see all of his work. I can skip to the next one. I used to work for a show called Day to Day, which was the midday news magazine on NPR. It's since been canceled. And one of our goals was to find the real people who were either experiencing the news or being affected by larger issues in the world. Sort of the way that yesterday we talked about how StoryCorps was this archive where you could find people who sort of were real-life examples of the news. Well, we were trying to do this on a daily basis, and one of the reasons that the show couldn't survive was that we were trying to, like, find 8 to 12 different new people every day to talk to who had been affected by the news. But let me play this for you. It's two short excerpts. And I don't have to do too much explanation. I think it's easier.
I'm Madeline Brand, Senator Barack Obama says he is outraged by recent speeches by his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright.
When I go to church, it's not respectable. It's to pray and to find a stronger sense of faith.
The church Senator Obama attended for more than 20 years is Trinity United Church of Christ on Chicago's South Side. We called a member there to see how the national media spotlight is affecting the congregation. Joyce Bristow is a retired area superintendent in Chicago's public schools, and she has attended Trinity for the past 10 years. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How are you handling all this attention?
Well, it is a buzzword at church constantly. I do feel that many of us are distracted somewhat by talking about what the media is saying and what's going on rather than the sermon that we just heard. It's a little discouraging a lot of times when we go to church and you see cameras all the time outside of the church, or you see messages on the door that say, any media please report to the office first. So it's a lot of that going on. Mm-hmm. You know, we still are happy to have our sermons and to hear our programs that are going full strength at the church.
Have the recent comments by Reverend Wright and the reaction yesterday from Senator Obama, have these changed your opinion or your feelings at all for Reverend Wright or for the church itself?
Well, I'm a little disappointed in some of the comments and the way that Reverend Wright responded. I will say that. I would rather him have come out to be more of a pastor and making pastoral comments rather than just trying to defend his name, because this is a much bigger picture than Reverend Wright. But I'm still a Trinitarian and I still go to church, and politics is not talked at church the way the media comes out with it on a regular basis. This is certainly not the emphasis in our church at all.
Senator Obama has had to break from the church because of the Reverend Wright and his public comments, his more controversial comments. He has said he is outraged by the recent speeches that Pastor Wright has given. And I'm just wondering, you know, as a member, as a congregant, do you feel that that is a shame in any way, that he has had to break so forcefully and so publicly with this man that he's known for the past 20 years?
Well, yeah, I do feel that this has hurt Obama, personally, that Reverend Wright came out with some of these comments, and that he would just absolutely have to distance himself from it. Not only for his campaign, but probably because of his own philosophies and feelings in general. And it is unfortunate.
Does it make you think, well, maybe I should look somewhere else?
I will say that I wish that Reverend Wright had talked about ways to unite all of the world and how we should try to bridge the gap and hold hands and pray and have peace together. But Reverend Wright is no longer the senior pastor at Trinity Church. I continue to feel that there's a place for me at Trinity Church.
And do you talk about this with other members of the church? Are they also
Yeah, there's pros and cons both. I mean, I was actually even in the beauty shop yesterday, and it was a big argument. Several people felt that Reverend Wright was absolutely right and defending himself and saying things to clear his name up or to respond to whatever the questions were the way he felt was appropriate. And there was another group, which I was on, that felt that he should have been bigger than that and responded more like he does at church every Sunday. And they felt that he had a right to say whatever he wanted to. And I felt that the picture is bigger than Reverend Wright. I felt that the backlash would be on Obama.
Well, Joyce Bristow, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you for calling me.
So one of the things that you're...
I totally remember this, listening to it at the time.
A little bit about how I found her. I was editing the show at the time, and I've been a religion reporter for Chicago Public Radio for about 10 years before I came to work for NPR in 2008. And I happened to, one good tip if you're a religion reporter is to, when you visit churches, pick up the directories. And I happened to have a directory at home, and so the day he made you'll recall that Jeremiah Wright sort of like had a meltdown at the National Press Club, and Obama responded by saying he was renouncing his membership at Trinity UCC. And I happened to, in a box somewhere, remember that I had their directory, and I just started calling people, some of whom I'd interviewed just as a religion reporter, and some of whom were just cold calls. And most of them were not happy that I was calling them, but I had actually interviewed her for a different story at one time. And she remembered and liked it. And so I got her to talk to the host of the show at the time.
Jason, isn't she unusually articulate for a woman on the street kind of interview? I mean, she's
clearly
used to public speaking and...
Well, she's a school superintendent.
Right.
One of the people always sort of comment on, like, everybody in public radio sounds so articulate, even the guests. Well, we probably interviewed her for 10 minutes and cut it to 4 minutes so that every stammer, every uncertainty is taken out. We pre-interview them. And so when we talk on the phone before they go in to talk to the host, I sort of had asked her some of these questions before. I talked to a couple of other people as well, and she was just the most articulate of all of them.
I've heard where the suspicion that I've had is like an editor or a producer had asked a series of questions to the interviewee, and had never the on-air personality, what I'll call, asked questions that, I mean... they weren't really asking the person the questions. They were asking the questions that fit what was recorded previously. Does that make any sense?
Well, they're not recorded. I mean, they're usually an editor or producer would talk to a guest beforehand to make sure that they can talk. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of people are incredibly inarticulate, or they're good at some things, but they're not good at talking. We don't put them on the radio.
Some stations, you I know.
Well, but in like part of what we do in public radio is like help people sound good, and then once we interview, she was pretty. I knew that she was upset, and I knew that she had this beauty shop experience that I was trying to get to at the end of the interview, and so Madeline knew to sort of get some real life experiences of arguments that had taken place.
But what I'm saying is that a producer interviews a person. Mm-hmm. The on-air person never really interviews, but just so I've heard that where the on-air
splicing
them
together.
That would be called something other than an interview. That's a tape and copy where you're writing a script around quotes, but we wouldn't present it as an interview. I mean, if the host never talked to the person, the host doesn't want their voice around the person's answers.
It's interesting with the beauty shop stuff because I was thinking a little bit about Studs Terkel and how he says that ordinary people are oftentimes the most interesting interviews because famous people are so used to being interviewed that you don't get those personal anecdotes that I think really make something a lot more compelling.
Yeah. Studs worked at WBEZ while I was there, so I had the great privilege of working with Studs in the last few years of his life. And then he died in 08, September, October of 08. He had the best, most disarming way of talking to real people because he would... he pretended to not know how to use the tape recorder, and so he'd been working in broadcasting for 50 years, and yet would always go and say, like, can you help me? And he would say to the guest, can you help me figure this out? I think I have to plug this into something, and I... Do you want to wear the headphones? I asked him what he was doing, and he was like, oh, well, you know, this is a weird experience for people, so what I'm trying to do is, you know, be sort of the bumbling person who asks them to help me, and then they start to get... calm around the equipment, so. I'm sorry.
I have to tell you, I had the great privilege of being interviewed by Spence some years back, and it was a little like that.
Yeah.
Because I used my hero, so.
It's great. Division Street USA and Working are two of my favorite oral histories. Although he did a third after his wife died, he did Will the Circle Be Unbroken about death. Life, death, and a hope for something. It was a really beautiful book.
Well, whom have some of your mentors been?
You know, they haven't been on-air people. My biggest mentor was my editor, my very first editor at NPR, Loretta Williams, who... still a very good friend of mine today. She no longer works at NPR. She now does independent documentary editing. It had little to do with interviewing, though. It had much more to do with writing and story structure and storytelling. The first piece that I did for NPR, I was in my third year of div school at the University of Chicago, and I wrote the most dense piece about the Dead Sea Scrolls. They came to town, and I had interviewed all these professors about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I just remember Loretta saying to me, nobody cares about almost anything you've written about in this book, in this story, because you're writing about, like, arguments over, you know, really internecine stuff. And she said, just tell the story of how they were found. That's interesting enough. And we haven't had a piece on our air for more than a decade about the Dead Sea Scrolls. So you've got to start the story by reminding people about how they were found and why they might be interesting. And just describe them. That's enough for the story. So she was my personal, you know, one-on-one mentor. But I would say that you know, my favorite interviewer is Terry Gross. I'm going to play the last interview I'll play this evening is one of my favorite interviews that she's done. And I've been listening to her since I was in middle school. Like, I would, you know, wake up early or come home from school and turn on Fresh Air and listen to her. She has, you know, I remember one of the very first interviews I ever heard her do was with this industrial engineer who designed garbage cans. And who would have thought that I would be interested in something about garbage can design? But it was just, I think she can talk to anybody about anything and make it interesting, from celebrities and that piece I'm going to play for you today, and to an industrial engineer, or to an author who, and she just spoke recently to a sleep scientist who I didn't really think I would be interested in, but, you know, she found the interesting part because she understands that her job is to just make people sort of learn something by taking delight in the thing that they're listening to.
Please. 2 winters ago, we had a weekly, we would listen to podcasts of Speaking of Faith, mm-hmm. on Being with Krista Tippett, and it's a wonderful show, and it was it stirred great discussion among us, but I found myself frustrated sometimes with this sense of this kind of accelerated intimacy thing, mm-hmm. this, like, kind of two friends kind of curled up with a cup of coffee kind of style that she has, mm-hmm. because it seemed at a certain point not to be journalism, because she, it seemed that there was hard questions weren't asked in a way, because it was this such a friendly context that there wasn't a lot of kind of pushing or poking that is an aspect of strong journalism, as I found.
I completely agree. I think Speaking of Faith is not journalism. It's a talk show.
Yeah.
But I would consider Fresh Air a talk show that is journalism. I don't think that Krista, I know Krista, and I don't think she would consider herself a journalist. She considers herself a conversationalist or something like that. My kind of meanish joke when she changed the name of the show to On Being was that I was going to have a show right afterwards that was called And Nothingness with Jason DeRose. I feel, to me, that show has become too precious. You know, I think that I liked the idea of it at the beginning, but she has never been a really hard interviewer.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't ask the necessarily difficult questions that I think should be asked. So when, like, Terry actually has a real interest in religion, and when she does a religion topic, she is quite, you know, she doesn't, I mean, Krista has an MDiv, and, you know, that's the ruin of us all. That's the ruin of me as a journalist. And I think that she thinks of herself more as sort of a public theologian, sort of
mm-hmm.
buddying up with these people,
mm-hmm.
rather than asking them the
yeah.
hard questions. Mm-hmm. I want to play for you one of my favorite little confrontory interviews that happened. And this is, I won't explain anything. I shouldn't try to gloss these before they...
We are hearing from our reporter, and he's on another line, thousands of people at the convention center in New Orleans with no food.
Well,
zero.
I'm telling you that we are getting food and water to areas where people are staging. And, you know, the one thing about an episode like this is if you talk to someone and you get a rumor or you get someone's anecdotal version of something, I think it's dangerous to extrapolate it all over the place. The limitation here on giving food and water to people is the condition on the ground. And as soon as we can physically move through the ground with these assets, we're going to do that. So,
but second, Ms. Secker, when you say that there is no issue to listen to rumors, these are things coming from reporters who have not only covered many, many other hurricanes, they've covered wars and refugee camps.
Well,
these aren't rumors, they're seeing thousands of people here.
I have not heard a report of thousands of people in the convention center who don't have food and water. I can tell you that I know specifically the Superdome, which was the designated staging area for a large number of vaccinees, does have food and water. I know we have teams putting food and water out at other designated evacuation areas. So, you know, this is, we've got plenty of food and water if we can get it out to people. And that is the effort we're undertaking.
I'd like to ask you, there is said to have been a report in, I think, 2001, which listed a catastrophic hurricane hitting New Orleans as one of the three worst potential disasters the country could face. As someone who inherited FEMA and who came to this, obviously, with 9/11 being the preoccupation that faced us all, have you had a plan somewhere in an office near yours that says, huge hurricane hits New Orleans, here's what we do in case of that catastrophe?
FEMA has plans for all foreseeable catastrophes. They've had plans for this kind of catastrophe, and they've exercised and worked on these plans. Recognizing this is a possibility over the weekend, we pre-positioned an unprecedented amount of food and water and ice. This mandatory evacuation was ordered and begun. But at the end of the day, as with any titanic struggle with nature, a plan only gets you so far in the face of the reality of struggling with miles of city that are underwater.
And our reporter said 2,000 people at the convention center without anything.
Now, I can't argue with you about what your reporter tells you. I can only tell you that we are getting water and food and other supplies to people where we have them staged, where we can find them, where we can get it. And, you know, if you're suggesting to me that somehow the National Guard missed a group of people, I will certainly call up and make sure they don't miss them. But I'm not in a position to argue with you about what your reporters tell me.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you.
It's Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security.
I hope to someday have the opportunity to ask questions like that of somebody in authority. I remember hearing that. At the time, I was a reporter for Day to Day at the time, and I was like getting ready to go down to New Orleans as this was all happening. And I think that Robert does this great thing of saying, we have a reporter on the other line. I believe Melissa was interviewing John Burnett was the reporter that he's referring to at the Superdome or at the convention center, and this wonderful, like, these aren't rumors. He turns to pass out, oh, I'm here. These are just rumors. These are not rumors. This is a reporter who has seen something. And what reporters do is bear witness to things. This is not a rumor. And I just love that pushback. And I think that, I don't think we do it nearly enough on NPR. I think I love watching or listening to interviews on the BBC, which are much more interrogations. People don't expect to have a nice, friendly conversation the way that when they sit down with Melissa Block or Michelle Norris or Renee Montaigne, that it's going to be fairly friendly. I think this was unusual, but it was also the level of indignancy that I don't think Robert thought this was going to be a confrontatory interview until he sort of said that John Burnett was just passing around rumors, which is not something that John Burnett, who has covered, you know, the Gulf War, the Iraq War, refugee camps.
But Robert is so calm.
Yeah.
So
polite. Oh, you can tell. There is indignance.
But there's certainly yeah. You can, it comes through, but, yeah. You know, I would have been screaming. That's why I don't interview.
I think that the job of the, if you're a host doing an interview as the host, I think that part of what you're trying to be is a surrogate for the listener. And, you know, very rarely do NPR hosts sound indignant, but I think this was a time when the level of indignancy coming from Robert probably matched the listeners' levels. Often, I think our hosts are not as upset as our listeners are. But I think that our listeners think that we're trying to be the opposite of Fox News when we are not. That is MSNBC. We are not trying to be the opposite of Fox News. We are trying to do very fair journalism that gives various people the opportunity to make the best arguments they can make on the air.
So in other words, NPR would never use the phrase. Now, some people are saying.
Oh, no, we would say that. I mean, as Robert writes in that, you know, you sort of, if you don't want to take responsibility for the question, you can always pass the question on.
The network, just to remain nameless, uses that phrase all the time and brings up off-the-wall things that, you know.
Right. I mean, it's setting up a straw man. And, you know, it can be used in an interview. I think it's best to name the critics rather than have a vague, some people are saying. Or as Robert says, the most loathsome thing. My editor wants me to ask this question. Now that I'm an editor, I'm sure that across this country I'm being blamed for difficult questions. So we've heard so far, sort of the first interview, which is sort of a meditation on the idea of interviewing, and then we heard the real person interview. And then I just played this sort of more confrontatory interview. I want to play an expert interview with you for you next, because these are some of my favorite interviews, and I happen to really like, I also booked and wrote the questions for this one as well. And again, you know, I think that every professor's sort of wet dream is to be on Fresh Air or NPR so that they can sell more than 8 books. This was an interview that we did the day before, in 2008, that same-sex marriage became legal in California.
Marriage has been the focal point of the gay rights movement for the past several years, but why marriage? Why not tackle discrimination in the workplace? Why not fight for the right to be with your loved one in the hospital? Why not any issue that's less fraught with religious and emotional overtones? To help us answer that question, we're joined now by George Chauncey. He teaches American history at Yale University, and he's also written a book called Why Marriage? The History Shaping Today's Debate Over Gay Equality. Welcome to the program, Professor Chauncey, and let's cut to the chase. Why marriage?
Granting the people the right to marriage has been a central symbol of their equality and full citizenship. So, for instance, slaves were denied the right to marry. And after emancipation, celebrating and officiating their marriages was one of the most important expressions of their new freedom. And at the same time, a lot of states then passed laws prohibiting blacks from marrying whites, which was a way of re-symbolizing their continued inequality. Nazis banned Jews from marrying non-Jews. And it was really in response to those sorts of laws that in 1948, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN declared the right to marry, the right to choose one's partner in marriage as a fundamental human right. It's historically been an incredibly powerful marker for both sides in the debate of full gay equality.
So this decision here in California to make same-sex marriages legal, how big of a milestone is this?
It's compelling that it's California, since in 1948, 60 years ago, California's state Supreme Court became the first state court to overturn its state's ban on interracial marriages. And in some ways, the reasoning used in both decisions was similar. This year, California voters faced a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. 30 years ago, in 1978, they voted on an initiative, the Briggs Initiative, that would have banned or would have required schools to fire gay teachers or any teacher, gay or straight, who expressed tolerance for homosexuality. And 30 years ago, having gay teachers seemed a little weird, even though California voters did turn down that referendum. 20 years ago, the Christian right mobilized huge boycott campaigns against TV sitcoms that had gay characters. And a lot of people thought that was kind of weird. Well, no one really thinks having gay characters in a sitcom is a weird thing today. And I think for those of us in our 50s and older, when we were young, it was just unthinkable that gay people could get married. But when I talk with my students today, even the most conservative of them on foreign policy issues or economic issues just think it's unthinkable that anyone would oppose gay marriage. They've just grown up in such a radically different society that they take it for granted that their gay friends should have the same rights that they do.
As we heard earlier in the program, there are a lot of homosexuals who are thrilled about this moment in history, but are there other gays and lesbians who feel maybe this particular battle wasn't the one to make the top of the list, that there were other issues that might have been better to take on?
Some people have felt it's the wrong priority. Some people have felt that they don't want to be a part of institutional marriage, but it's not the only issue that's in play right now.
Well, what are some of the big issues that you see being on the frontiers and in the future of the gay rights movement?
Everything from the harassment of openly gay students in high schools to the rights of transgender people to the rights of people with HIV and AIDS. I think that we'll also see a continuation of the great debate that's been taking place in the churches for the last 20 years. That will be probably a central element of the debate in the next years.
George Chauncey is author of the book, Why Marriage? He teaches history at Yale University. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hadn't listened to that in a really long time, and then that last question, he actually very nicely predicted the last four or five years of coverage. There aren't many organizations that still interview experts because they just like to interview people who yell at each other across across studio or over camera. And I think that one of my favorite things about working in public radio is that we still sort of value expertise. And George had been a professor of mine when I was at the USC, and then he since left and went to Yale. And so I, you know, had his home phone number and I was able to find him. And he was willing to go into a studio, you know, that same morning and talk to us.
You had said ahead of time that you had written the questions for that. When a topic is something that is so very near and dear to your own heart and life, what kind of conversation do you have with yourself, or do you have one when you, you know, which hat are you putting on when you prepare that interview?
I think I have all my hats on all at once. I try to write questions that will help people who don't know much about the topic and be able to enter into the topic, which is why the questions go from a little sort of gather it all in, like why marriage, to very specific, why the history of California being so interesting. I think that we talk about this a lot at NPR. The reason that we want there to be so much diversity in the newsroom is that we want people who have had real experiences at the editorial table to say this is important and here's why. So I think it's very important to wear all of those hats all at once, not to say, and now I'm a journalist, and now I'm a person. You're always a person and a journalist, and a husband and a father and whatever.
Could you talk a little bit about, kind of building off that question, just in general, what are some of the processes that you guys go through in terms of working to make your questions and your interviews balanced? I mean, what? Right. I mean, we know you're an editor, but what are some of the other processes you guys go through?
So, usually every day at an editorial meeting, there will be, you know, a list of pieces, reported pieces, that are coming from various desks: the National Desk, the Washington Desk, the Science Desk, Foreign Desk, Arts Desk, Business Desk,
the Front Desk.
Yeah. And then there will be, the show does what we call two ways, or interviews. And if there are three people involved, it's called a three-way, and it's very funny when you hear that page over the system, your three-way is in Studio 2. So, you know, what we're looking to do is balance the, sort of the straightforward reported pieces, sort of the policy pieces, or the piece from the state capitol in Oregon talking about gun control, with conversations, and hosts want to be present in the show as something more than somebody who just reads the intros to pieces. You know, in any given show, the hosts are looking to have a combination of expert interviews, real person interviews, newsmaker interviews, and these, you know, so Chertoff would be an example of a newsmaker interview, real person is the Madeline Brand interview with the member of Trinity UCC. You know, in a more sort of heated confrontatory interview, like the one with Chertoff, we knew that Robert was going to have to take a more sort of hard stand with him. With, if you're talking to a real person, like Chertoff has to talk to you because he is an appointed government official and has to answer to the public. You know, that school superintendent doesn't have to talk to us, and if she had hung up in the middle of the interview, we wouldn't have probably aired her hanging up because there's no expectation that a private citizen should have to talk to us. Just out of their kindness and their willingness to want other people to understand the situation. I mean, I think we're always thinking about, I'll give you this example, the day that the Supreme Court overturned the, it was a gun ban in either Atlanta or Chicago, but it affected both cities. And we got the mayor of Atlanta on the phone. And we had this, we also had somebody from the NRA on the phone, and we kept sitting there, like, and I think we made the wrong decision. We went with the mayor of Atlanta because we thought this person has a bigger name. But we went with the loser first, and we should have gone with the winner first. We did sort of the opposite of this the day that Obama came out in favor of same-sex marriage. There was a piece from the White House, so Ari Shapiro did a piece out of the White House just saying, here's what Obama said today. And then we followed it up with an interview with Andrew Sullivan, I think. And then it wasn't until like much later in the show that we found, like, I think it was the senator, Democratic senator from West Virginia who's opposed to same-sex marriage, Manchin. But he was like way later in the show. And you know, in an instance like that, I think we made the wrong decision on day-to-day to put the loser first. And I think we should have kept the loser near the winner in that other decision. Because I know that our listeners are not all of one mind on this. Now, actually, our listeners, we do a ton of audience research. Our listeners are about 40% Democrats, 40% Republicans, and 20% you know, people who classify as independent. They tend to be similarly divided among economic and foreign policy, conservative, liberal, moderate, and then on social issues, they tend to be much more to the left of like the rest of the country. Something like 65% would consider themselves to the left of center on social issues. That happens to be because our audience has like very, very, very high college graduation levels, which they tend to go together. think he said like 34-35% of the population of the United States has a BA, but something like 85% of the population that listens to NPR. And I always like to tell people, like, only 10% of the U.S. population listens to NPR, but probably everybody in this room grew up listening to it, and everybody you know listens to it. You're a very tiny group of people in America. So that's something we try to keep in mind. And, you know, we're interested in expanding our audience. Not that we're going to, we're never going to have everybody listening, but we want to present, you know, a fair portrait of America. So we do, you know, we do think about how we're putting people on the air, what order we're putting them on the air, and, you know, do we have people who are both happy and upset about the decisions being made on the air today, and in what order we put them on. I know we're out of time, but I just have this great little fun issue.
Sure.
It's 7 minutes long, and I don't want you to relate to your next thing. Is that okay? I don't want to.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I can hang out and take some other questions afterwards if you want to. This is one of my favorite interviews that I've heard in a really long time. Fresh Air, as I said earlier, is my favorite program. I listen to the podcast every day. And what I love about this is that this is an interview with Terry Gross is interviewing Tom Ford, the fashion designer who he was on the show because he had just directed the movie A Single Man. A Single Man. I confused that with A Serious Man, which came out, I think, at the same time, but it was a very different movie. But this is a part of the interview that is not at all about the movie. It's about advertising. And I think about the way that they are interacting, which is, I think, very different from the other interviews that you've heard tonight. And also, it's slightly risque, so there aren't any little kids in the room. Only slightly risque. I mean, it was broadcast on NPR.
One thing that you're famous for is some of the ads that you've done with very provocative, naked or barely clothed people. So let me just describe a couple of more famous ones. Okay.
Go ahead.
So there's the Gucci ad where there's a woman with like a kimono that's open, revealing her naked body underneath. She's wearing brief underwear, but it's pulled down, revealing a shaved, that her pubic hair is shaved in a G for the
Gucci. I'm so happy you brought this up. May I tell you about it?
Yeah. And, wait, let me
go
finish
ahead.
The picture of that.
All right.
A young, very attractive man is kneeling very provocatively right in front of her with his hand on her right leg.
Yes.
So, you were saying.
I'm really glad you asked me about that. Because, first of all, in fashion, as in life, the right thing at the right time is the right thing. The right thing at the wrong time is the wrong thing. I wouldn't necessarily do that ad today. Because we're in a different world and we're in a different time. And it isn't necessarily something that needs to be said culturally at this particular moment in time. However, at that moment in time, that was meant as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek take on where we were with branding in our culture. And of course, you know, I was at Gucci and branding everything. Everything had a G on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Vuitton, everything had an LV on it. And we had come to a point in our culture, you know, globalization had really kicked in with the internet in the early 90s, and we were at a point where all of a sudden everyone all over the world was consuming exactly the same thing at the same time. And branding, everything became a brand. And, you know, there was nothing left to brand. So the idea is that this young man is branding his girlfriend, and she's wearing a brand. Sex and the City picked up on this, and there was actually an episode where Samantha is dating a guy, and he shaves her pubic hair into a kind of lightning bolt, I believe, and branded her. And she then later goes to the gym, and she's in the steam room, and she sees all these other women with the same brand, and she realizes they slept with the same guy. The first thing about advertising is it needs to be arresting. It needs to make you stop and look. And sometimes challenge you and make you think.
Okay, another famous ad of yours. This is for Opium Perfume. Yves Saint Laurent Opium Perfume. And Sophie Dahl is naked on her back she's like lying on a drape of some, like a velvet drape or satin drape or something.
Yeah, satin actually.
Satin, okay. And her head is kind of thrown back in ecstasy as she touches her breast.
You're funny. I don't even remember
do remember why I did that ad and how we thought of it, and she probably is touching her breast because you probably have the picture right
now. I have it right here. Okay, you also should wear it. Go ahead.
They're beautiful high heels, too, and she looks great. She's a very beautiful girl. Yes, at that moment in time, I was working for Yves Saint Laurent and designing the collection there, and we were relaunching a fragrance. Yves was the very first fashion designer to send transparent clothes down the runway in the 60s. And he was, sex and sensuality were a very big part of what Yves Saint Laurent did. So this seemed a natural extension. And by the way, I find that picture classically beautiful. I don't find it upsetting, obscene, I find the human body really beautiful. I do not find sex or depictions of sex, if they're not done in a violent way, at all upsetting. I couldn't sometimes understand, the big deal. That particular image you have of Sophie Dahl was banned in certain countries. And for me, her skin is alabaster. It's absolutely beautiful. It is not a sexual picture. It is an elegant, beautiful picture for me of a very, very beautiful woman.
What gets to me sometimes about the naked sexual fashion ads is that sometimes the people in it look so vain and self-absorbed. It's kind of like, I'm so in love, I'm so passionate about
it's
myself.
Yeah, that's tired. I think we're finished with that, I hope.
There's one more ad. This one, I think, never ran in the United States because it is a man full frontal, complete.
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking about that, too.
Yves Saint Laurent fragrance N7. This is, it's unimaginable that this would run in a mainstream magazine in the United States right now. So
it is.
Yeah, where did you get this published? And why did you do it?
Well, why did I do it? Again, I'm an equal opportunity objectifier. No, really. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. By the way, I post nude, quite a few times. So we do objectify women in our culture. We're starting to objectify men a little bit more, and there's nothing wrong with that. Objectify men is the wrong word. Celebrate their bodies and use beautiful men, beautiful women, as a tool to get your attention and to sell things. But we're very, very uncomfortable in our culture with looking at a naked man. Naked women are everywhere, selling everything. And again, this is quite sexist, but naked men make us nervous. And Yves Saint Laurent posed nude for his first men's fragrance, and it was groundbreaking at the time. So I thought, all right, we're launching the new Yves Saint Laurent men's fragrance. What perfect way than to continue the tradition and vocabulary of the House of Yves Saint Laurent by, publishing the first full frontal male nude. And by the way, this is not a sexual picture. He's a very beautiful man, shot in a very simple, classic way, and it's really about his beauty. Perfume, by the way, too, is about smell and skin, and so nudity and perfume, I think, makes perfect sense,
Hold on. I just wanted to say that it is very sexually provocative, whether he's...
Do you think? Why is it more provocative than a sculpture in marble of a nude man? There's nothing sexual about what he's doing. He just happens to be... Are you sure you're not just thinking that because you're not used to looking at a full frontal male nude?
It's shot and lit in a very romantic way. And
romantic, yes. But romantic, is that provocative?
Well, romantic and naked, usually. I'm not saying.
I enjoy looking at Sophie Dahl. She's a beautiful woman. And by the way, she's also not model thin or what we normally think of as model thin. She is. Much more full figured than most models are.
I love that interview so much.
What is the This American Life thing? This clip acknowledges the existence of sex?
Yes.
We often do warnings like that, because the two things that people who listen to public radio, we never talk about, sex or television, which are basically the two things that most Americans do with their free time. But if you listen to NPR, you might think all we did was read novels and listen to classical music. But no. A couple of things that I love about this interview. Terry knows the kind of interview this is. It is just a delight. She's having this sort of fun banter with Tom Ford, and I think that she didn't know how incredibly smart and thoughtful he was. I had no idea that Tom Ford was smart and thoughtful. I thought he designs clothing, and that's all I could have told you about it. And then I saw his movie, and I thought he was a good director too, but does he actually think about what he's doing? And I just love that this revealed a lot to me about the character of Tom Ford through their sort of disagreement and her sort of kidding around with him, and he, you know, is able to kid around with her. And I think they've got this great repartee, and something that, this to me is sort of her working at the top of her form to sort of allow herself to sound a little sort of humorously indignant, and then to get to sort of tease him out to make his case and to help him sound really good, I think. I mean, I think he makes a great, great case.
Yeah. One thing I love about Terry is she often feels pretty unscripted. She has places she wants to go, but she leaves a lot of elasticity. Yeah. And that keeps it real and fresh, as opposed to question 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
She doesn't. She usually writes little questions.
Yeah.
When I've been in Philadelphia, I love to sit in and watch her. She has a ton of sort of material spread out in front of her, and she has some topics that she wants to get to, but she might only have 1 or 2 questions actually written down. I always think this is the best piece of advice when interviewing that I was ever given. And if I had a do's and don'ts of interviewing, which I actually do have a PowerPoint, but I thought this would be more interesting than me going through a PowerPoint. It's to, you know, don't go in with 25 questions that you try to get through. Go in with a couple of questions that you, and if you're a journalist, you've got to go in with, like, you know, specific pieces of information. But most of the time, what you want to do is get people talking in stories and telling stories, and then ask them good follow-up questions based on that very first question. And then what happened? And what did that experience mean to you? That can be, the whole interview can just be those two questions.
We'll notice, I noticed one thing in there when she was talking about that photograph, and he said, and you probably have that photograph right
here. Oh, I have it right here.
And it reminded me back with the interview on the Katrina interview. Mm-hmm. You know, she had the evidence, mm-hmm. and she knew what she was talking
right.
about.
Right.
And the other guy, I hate it when people tell you, well, you know, you, that's really not happening.
Right.
I'm looking at it.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that people like to think that all facts are negotiable, and that's not true. Part of what journalists do is to sort of look for evidence and ask people questions about it. It's not unlike perhaps sort of creating a theory of the crime when you're a prosecutor. You're trying to ask a certain line of questions. When I've done a similar presentation to this in the past, I thought it would perhaps be I'm not sure that you would want an 8-foot naked Sophie doll projected up here, but I do have them on my computer. So I do. So when I've done this in the past, I show these photos as he's talking about them, so you have an idea.
Oh, shoot.
Mary, I have them right here. I could project them if you'd like.
I'm always impressed with Terry Gross at how she's clearly deeply educated herself about the work of the writer or whatever. She's deeply sort of researched and engaged so that she can come at it with this kind of fresh but deeply thoughtful and knowledgeable perspective, but it gives this kind of lively but informed character to her questioning and the conversation that ensues.
Yeah, it's, you know, she's probably the hardest working person in all of public radio. I mean, she has about 20 producers who, you know, as Terry would say, the producer reads the book, I read the book. As in, the producer has highlighted big sections of the book or says, you know, if it's nonfiction especially, she might concentrate on a couple of chapters of the book. But, you know, she's often has 3 or 4 authors a week on it. No, she couldn't possibly But she does read the book, as in she drags her eyeballs over big sections of those books. The reason she talks about, she said this in the past, that she doesn't do a ton of fiction is that she likes fiction so much that she wants to actually read the book. Like, it's hard to talk to a novelist about the only reading a little bit of the novel. But she, you know, she does just tons and tons of homework. In a recent interview, she had this great, she was interviewing somebody about the science of sleep, and she was talking about how she will do all of her research in the afternoon and evening. They generally tape their interviews around between 9 and noon. And then they're edited. Usually they're not airing the same day, usually then edited for the next day's show. But she said she does her research sort of from sort of 1 until midnight when she's reading and listening to music and watching TV shows. But she never writes her questions until the next morning because she needs to sort of sleep on all of the research that she's read. And then she's had the chance to think about it and write those few questions that she goes in with and has some lines of follow-up. I had this profoundly sad moment the other day when I thought, Terry is 64 years old and she's not going to be hosting that show forever.
Jason, back to your description of the magic of radio, I was being facetious about the photos because part of the delight of listening to that interview was not seeing the photos, hearing her describe, listening to them debate it. Mm-hmm. And if it had been a television interview and we'd been looking at the photos, it wouldn't have had that flavor at all.
I don't think you would have seen some of the photos.
There would be some black bar over the photos. Black bar. I actually probably couldn't have shown any of them on TV. But
that is radio. A radio interview does allow a much bigger picture to occur in the mind than a television interview.
Susan Stamberg talks about the pictures are better on the radio.
Yeah.
And I have to say, since we launched our website that is very aggressively a news website about 5 years ago, or 4 to 5 years ago, I'm often now trying to get reporters to take pictures of things, and I'd rather not see a photograph of the house destroyed. That, you know, Wade Goodwin did this great piece when Moore, Oklahoma was destroyed, where, yes, we had a photographer there doing photos for the website, but his description of the woman was that her entire body was, I think it was something like glazed with pink insulation. Like, she just, like, the house had blown up around her, and what she had all over her was pink insulation as he was interviewing her. And I think, you know, the way that he described it was so much better than a photo of her. And I also, there's a certain anonymity to radio that I really like, and often we can get people to talk to us when they would never talk to a television reporter, because even if, we insist on using their full name and their real name, but there is still some anonymity. They're not going to end up on YouTube. We archive all those interviews online, but again, very few people actually listen to NPR. So, and we're actually way over time, but I'm happy to answer a few more questions. But feel free to go if you.
Earlier, you were talking about the shape of the interview and how you edited it from the we gather it all in, and then you got down to the details. As people are asking questions, like using your question list, is that the way you suggest going at it? Starting from the, in sort of a, just like you write, here's our thesis question, and then details, and or do you just want to let it go another way?
I would say, you know, if you're sitting down for, say, the National Day of Listening, and you want to just sort of, you know, interview your grandmother about her life, I don't think you should try to think about it as I'm trying to create something I'm going to end up editing down. But I think there are great things that you could do. You could edit it down. I mean, I actually have thought of doing a workshop like this for congregation. Like, my congregation recently had its 85th anniversary, and there are still some people alive who were, like, baptized at this church at, like, the first as it opened. And it would be great to interview them. Now, you would want in the archive the hour or several hour long interview. But say you were going to do a little like Memories of St. Paul's of Santa Monica on the website, no one's going to listen to a 3 hour interview on the website, so you would probably take a 2 or 3 minute moment from it. Similar to the way StoryCorps works, where you know, Annie and Danny have hours and hours of interviews, and you probably never heard more than 5 minutes of any, like, there were a bunch of little excerpts, but you've never heard more than about 5 minutes broadcast.
One of the most amazing interviews I heard with Terry Gross interviews was the Gene Simmons one that went just horribly awry and was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Because it left behind any script or like even kind of sensibility and just went off the rails, but it made amazing journalism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there have been three or four interviews that have gone totally off the rails. I think the Gene Simmons was the first one of several afterwards. There was one with Monica Lewinsky walked out of the studio. Lynn Cheney basically kept saying, I'm not going to answer that question, because she was there to promote some children's book she'd written. And then there was somebody else.
Did Bill O'Reilly also?
Oh, Bill O'Reilly walked out of the studio on her seat. Yeah. When it goes off the rails, it goes really off the rails. The Gene Simmons one was strange, though, because, I mean, he was there to promote his book. And usually when a celebrity is there to promote a book, they've had some kind of media training. And, like, they've sat down with a publicist who's there to help them sell their book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the first probably things that the media trainer says is don't insult and degrade the person interviewing you, especially somebody who's like beloved like Terry Gross. I mean, if it's somebody that no one's heard of, it's one thing. It's another thing. You know, everybody's on Terry's side on the show. The listeners are on Terry's side. Yes?
Speaking of being on the interviewer side, I feel like I've heard some instances where the interviewer goes too hard on the interviewee, and then, you know, you go on the comment section of the website and they just get absolutely slammed by 3,000 irate people that you were a jerk to this person. Do you feel like there's a line that you have to watch? Do you feel any like responsibility for the welfare of the person that you are interviewing?
I think if it's a real person, I feel great responsibility. I actually despise open commenting on websites.
I think it is the
CB radio of our time, or the ham radio of our time, or whatever mean, nasty thing I can think of our time. Because, you know, in newspapers, there have always been letters to the editor, but they were heavily edited for concision and civility. And you wouldn't put crazy people in the letters to the editor section. We seem to let this, it's sort of this open steam valve, and I never read the comments. And I always, 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 if there are real people in a story, I always tell the reporter, because I don't really interact with the guests anymore, because I edit reporters who are interviewing people. I just say, tell them to not read the comments. Just nothing good will come of reading the comments. I think we're at this weird point in like news websites where people comment people comment differently in different ways online. So on the NPR website, if you read the comments, like, I don't know, the crazy shut-ins of America are the people writing in those comments. But if you read our Facebook comments, where you actually have to be something like, you have to be a version of yourself on Facebook versus the crazy person, you can actually have like sort of fake icons of things on our website. I think it's very badly set up, but some guru seems to think that comments are content, and I don't think they are. But you know, I'm the editor who tries to have a lot of control over the material, and I don't like the idea that there's material that's uncontrolled on our website. But on Facebook, I think there's actually a really interesting conversation going on. If you're a friend of NPR, got like 2.5-3 million people who are friends of NPR. And there's an interesting, you know, conversation going on, because they can't hide behind a crazy icon and a fake identity. They're hiding behind their Facebook fake identity rather than their even crazier fake identity.
Yeah.
There's an interview that was a couple of weeks ago and went kind of viral on a gentleman who wrote a book on Jesus, the history of Jesus, the extremists, or I can't remember the title of it.
Zealot.
Zealot. And can you critique where, I mean, it's obvious to me that she went wrong, the interviewer, but how in the world, because she kept on coming back to that same thing, she kept on.
But you're not a Christian.
You're not a Christian, you're a Muslim, how can you write about Jesus?
Which, so Reza Aslan appeared on Fox after he had appeared on Weekend Edition Sunday and after he'd appeared on Fresh Air. So he was on for about 7 or 8 minutes on Weekend Edition. Uh-huh. And then he was on for, I think, the full hour, or most of the hour on Fresh Air, like a week or so before he was on Fox News. The book was not the number one bestseller when NPR did it because, you know, we have a small audience. Although people who buy books actually do listen to us. He said nothing during that interview that he didn't say to Terry or Rebecca Martin. Yeah, Rachel Martin. But, you know, I think that he was very smart and his publicists were very smart. I know Reza, he teaches at Riverside, UC Riverside, so he's very smart and knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, because it was just, he kept repeating the same answer, mm-hmm. a very civil yeah. answer. And
she kept there's nothing to be gained by fighting with a Fox News anchor. I mean, if you remain calm, they'll get upset, and they'll just get more upset.
Of course, I didn't watch it on Fox News.
You can take the higher ground.
I got it through Facebook. Oh. Somebody told me to look at it.
Okay, well, thank you. We've gone way, way over. I'm sorry. Have a good night.